This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It's no secret that wealth has become an important source of power in the American political system. Super PACs, lobby groups, and business leaders have their say by funding or defunding political efforts. And the push for privatization of everything from schools to healthcare may lower tax bills, but it won't necessarily lower costs for most of us, and it certainly doesn't guarantee better quality. Duke professor Nancy McLean wanted to find out more about the ideology behind the capitalist right, the group that's pushing for privatization and deregulation. Her new book is called Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. Nancy McLean is William Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University. She's going to be at the Regulator Bookshop tonight in Durham, but first on the State of Things. Nancy McLean, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a story that, one way or another, most of us have intuited. Wealth is power in the United States, and it's becoming ever more the case. You took the deep dive, and I think the story about how you found one of the chief characters in this, James McGill Buchanan, is a fascinating one. So take us back to that and your discovery.
Sure. Well, I'm a scholar of social movements with a particular interest in the South. And in 2006, I happened on a story that I had not encountered before, which was the story of the Prince Edward County, Virginia school closures from 1959 to 1964. And it was really heartrending. I was at the American Friends Service Committee archives, and I was seeing the pictures. They had interviews. I was just so moved by this story. And so I started digging into that story because I also noticed in the materials there that this was the first time that vouchers had been used in a modern context, tuition grants.
This
for
is part of the massive resistance.
Yes, I'm sorry,
of
part of
Brown
the massive
versus,
resistance
right?
to
so
Brown
they're going
to versus...
close the schools and make them all private. Right?
Exactly. They were pushing to privatize the schools to resist the federal government's mandate to desegregate public schools. And so I was just very intrigued with this because it was this older story, yet it seemed to speak to our own time in such significant ways. And as I dug in, I found out that Milton Friedman, the famous University of Chicago economist who wrote a book called Capitalism and Freedom, that is probably his best known popular work, he had written a manifesto for school vouchers in 1955. And as I dug in some more, I realized that he would have known that the most arch segregationists in the South were saying they were going to shut down public education to defy the Supreme Court. So at first I thought my story was about this Southern story plus Milton Friedman and trying to understand how someone who was an advocate of what he called the free society could possibly be, you know, in effect assisting these Southern segregationists. And in fact, that his materials were being circulated in Virginia, I found out. But this other guy jumped out at me from a footnote, about a study from a new center that had been set up at the University of Virginia in 1956, just after the state passed all the massive resistance legislation. And it was by a man named James McGill Buchanan and his colleague Warren Nutter, who were the co-founders of this center, both Chicago-trained economists. And they jumped in 1959, after there'd been a huge mobilization of moderate white parents and clergy and so forth to keep the schools open, and two federal courts had said that Virginia could not shut the schools to keep students from attending these desegregated schools. And it was 10 days after that decision that they issued this report that effectively use their discipline of economics to make a case for privatizing Virginia schools and saying that that wouldn't cause a problem, it wouldn't hurt the public school system, it would actually make for better schools, all the language we know now, you know, it would end the government monopoly on schooling and so forth. And I was just stunned. And then also they had sent it to one legislator who was known for being frankly, quite a racist. The cover letter said that they were issuing this report and letting the chips fall where they may, was the quote, letting the chips fall where they may. And that just, I have to say, it hit me in the gut. And it just got me thinking, like, who would do this? You know, and how could people who had access to such advanced higher education, you know, so many privileges, not see what they were contributing to? So it was just something that gnawed at me. But still, I thought I was following the other school story. And then as time went on, I learned more and more about this James McGill Buchanan and found out that he was the founder of a very important school of political economy for which he'd been awarded a Nobel Prize in 1986, that he was actually one of the most original thinkers about about democracy in the modern, certainly in modern America, sadly in a very critical way. But anyway, he just got, oh, and then I found out that he had been very important in Chile in advising on a constitution that, and on policies, his ideas had really shaped the policies that the Pinochet junta had put in to privatize, deregulate, et cetera, all the kinds of things you were just talking about. And so he got more and more on my radar, but I'm sorry for this. It's like sort of a Shaggy Dog story. Is it okay to say one more bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. No, this deep background is important, and we'll pull the threads as
okay,
we keep
great.
Going.
So I was at that time living in Chicago and teaching at Northwestern, but in 2010, I moved to North Carolina just as the new kind of radical right General Assembly was coming into office. And suddenly I realized that these very abstract things that I was reading about in Buchanan's works, and I was trying to make sense of at the level of theory, I could see them happening in the state. And it just shocked me. So as I watched this rollout, I just thought, wait a minute, I need to start following this guy. And I kind of developed some hypotheses about his work and its significance and its importance for us. And those hypotheses were confirmed when I got into his private papers in 2013.
Well, here's the wonderful part about the research. It seems to me that it what it does is expose the inner workings of the black box, because you talk
yes.
about an argument over education mm-hmm. policy, which would be a kind of frontal forum on whether or not closing these schools and segregation is a good or a bad thing, and we would bring our data and we would all discuss it. That would be the public policy question, and as you suggested, moderate whites were not in favor of this. They weren't buying it.
No.
And so then now there's this other question, and here's where the marble takes a turn inside the box. We start talking about personal freedom.
Yes.
They're taking mm-hmm. away your personal freedom by telling you that public education has to include everybody.
Yes. And that was another thing that really struck me, Frank, is that the group that was promoting these school closures, the Virginia equivalent of the White Citizens Councils of the Deep South, was called the Defenders of State Sovereignty and Individual Liberty. And so that emphasis on individual liberty, I think for most of us, I mean, how could you be saying this in the Jim Crow South, where, in fact, with part of the suite of legislative measures that the Virginia General Assembly passed in massive resistance, it also effectively disempowered the NAACP. I believe it was five different laws were aimed at the NAACP to prevent the NAACP from effectively using its First Amendment rights. So it was really quite a stunning thing. And yet these guys continue to talk about individual liberty. And I found that the libertarian movement of the era, which was still very tiny and marginal, but they were all excited that Virginia was talking about privatizing its schools. And so I just got intrigued. And it's like, you know, it was a puzzle to me. The civil rights struggle, as many of us know, you know, certainly with SNCC from 1960 onward, its slogan was freedom now, right? And yet these people were talking about liberty, and they were really digging on their heels on the other side. So it was really an intellectual puzzle for me, a historical puzzle. It was a place where other scholars, you know, had not gone yet. And so it took me a long time to figure it out.
This ability then to disguise the public argument on the merits of whatever it is, whether mm-hmm. it's public health or public education, on something a more identity-based, your freedom as a white guy is mm-hmm. being taken away from you, becomes the intellectual architecture that is the foundation mm-hmm. of the Southern strategy for Republicans, and is also embraced by some fairly important and influential wealthy individuals, the Koch brothers, for mm-hmm. one. So let's talk about how these ideas of James McGill Buchanan make their way into American politics today.
Sure. Well, one thing I will say is I do believe that at least the two key figures I was looking at, James McGill Buchanan and Charles Koch, I believe they took these ideas very seriously. And I believe that they are principled in their way. You know, I just think that they have an ethical system that is very different from yours and mine and from that of most other Americans. And it has not been understood in those terms. And I don't think that we as citizens of North Carolina or citizens of the United States can deal with the threat to our democracy that we're seeing now unless we understand this ethical system in its own terms. That said, in terms of how they came together, Charles Koch's first philanthropy involved promoting private schools. And he had something called the Center for Independent Education that James Buchanan started to work with. They collaborated there. Charles Koch joined something called the Mont Pelerin Society, which brought together these free, you know, some people refer to them as free market thinkers. I think it's actually something else, but that's going down a rabbit hole. Anyway, Charles Koch joined that in 1970 and then used that to build for his various operations. And so they were working together in different ways. James Buchanan helped with the setting up of what became the Cato Institute. He was a regular at with that for years, the Heritage Foundation, all these organizations of the modern right. So that was actually another thing that was very interesting to me as a scholar, is we've had many works about the think tanks that have worked with, you know, to promote corporate interests and against kind of what many of us would say sort of popular interests. And we've had a lot of work on that, but we haven't had so much from the inside. So the really interesting thing about getting into Buchanan's papers was seeing that from the early 1970s forward, he was actually, in his way, a movement architect. You know, he realized the need to build what he called the counterintelligentsia. He was working with top political officials. He was inviting in corporate leaders to hear about his ideas. So it really was a movement-building enterprise. Ironically, though, I will say, I think of it as the anti-social movement, social movement.
Yeah, but what about the principled argument? Look, individuals should have the right to choose. Why is the government telling me what is the best way to educate children? Why don't I, as an agent of my own, you know, mm-hmm. with my own agency and intellect and mm-hmm. will, have the right to make these choices? Why should the government be telling me that public education is the way to go? What about
right.
that principle?
Well, that and actually that was answered by the African-American civil rights activists at the time and the white moderates who said that, look, no, you don't have to go to a public school. Go to a private school. But you don't have a right to have taxpayers subsidize your prejudices and your effort to discriminate by staying away from some of your fellow citizens. And black journalists and black activists and black clergy and white moderates made that argument over and over again in Virginia in this period. So it's not like it wasn't heard. You have absolute freedom to go to a private school. You have absolute freedom to go to a religious school or a parochial school. But you can't expect your fellow taxpayers to subsidize your prejudices.
You've got the word stealth in the title of your book, Democracy and Change, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plan for America. So talk about the way in which this argument is funded and then the way it appears sort of in the press and how mm-hmm. it's played out.
Yeah, I would actually say the single most important thing I would like people to learn from my book and to take away from it is that this is a cause that understands that it will never ever attract a majority of Americans to its views and its vision of the good society if it is honest about that vision. And so it has learned from experience that the way to go about this is by stealth. And I mean, I could go through the list of the historical learning that I talk about in the book, beginning with Barry Goldwater, who, you know, we tend to think of as, you know, this raging right-wing conservative, but he loved Friedrich Hayek. He advocated Social Security privatization. He called for flat taxes. He was against government anti-discrimination. He was a libertarian, except in foreign policy. And he was roundly rejected by the American electorate. The only places he won were his home state of Arizona and the states of the Deep South that practice the most aggressive voter suppression. So that learning was built on then Ronald Reagan, you know, talk the talk, but when he was faced with doing things that were hugely unpopular that would turn the American people against him in a fight on Social Security, he backed off. Sure. And so again and again, this cause has seen that legislators will not go to the brink for these ideas when people understand what they're about. And so what Charles Koch came up with that was really ingenious. The man is extremely smart, and I think he's been underestimated by his critics. He realized that Buchanan's ideas supplied what he called a technology that could get him what he wanted. And he actually has talked about that in quite messianic terms, describing himself, comparing himself to Martin Luther and the Protestant Reformation. He said he wanted to unleash the kind of force that propelled Columbus to his discovery. So this is a man with a pretty audacious vision. And what he learned from James Buchanan's political economy was that you didn't have to tell the public the truth and to persuade them, that you could actually engage in changing the rules without people noticing. So Buchanan regularly said from the 70s forward that the key thing was not to change the rulers, not to focus on who rules, but to focus on the rules. And he even, beginning in the early 1970s, began calling for constitutional revolution, for extremely radical rules change. So what he was calling for in the abstract, after 1997, Charles Koch invested in a big way to do practical tactically. So that's what we're seeing here. And we've seen it in North Carolina.
And you said that the voter ID, for instance, is a pretty good example of that.
Yes. Yeah. That's, again, you know, being in North Carolina, it just – sometimes it just left me breathless and, frankly, feeling nausea. I mean, it was like a bodily reaction to what was going on because I could see what was happening in North Carolina was an application of these ideas I'd been struggling to understand in the abstract. So, yes, the you know, what Democracy North Carolina called the monster voter suppression bill, which didn't just have voter ID, but it also eliminated early voting. You know, it prevented young people from pre-registering to vote. I mean, it was a broad-gauged assault on democracy, frankly.
And anything that has to do with government involvement in particular businesses. So, for instance, health care.
Yes.
And I think there might be another example where you have Mitch McConnell, who's, thought to be a genius at crafting the compromise, is promoting a bill in the first iteration of that had 12% of the support of the American public. So clearly he knew that there was no popular support and yet was pressing it on, which I think may speak to. So where is the pressure coming from to continue to get the government out of healthcare?
Yes, I'm so glad that you raised healthcare because it is a perfect illustration of the pattern that I trace in the book. And that is that this operation has realized that, again, constituents are going to press legislators to do things that the libertarians do not want to see done. And so from Buchanan, one of the core teachings of his public choice thought, which is broader than him, but his particular variant of it, is to change the incentives, right? To tweak the incentives to get the result you want. So in this particular case, we have so many journalists saying, why would anybody be pushing a bill that nobody wants? They hate it. The people hate it. They're scared. They don't want to lose their health care. They think this is wrong. Why are they doing it? Well, the reason they're doing it is because the donor network, this vast donor network assembled by Charles Koch, has changed the incentives. So with groups like Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce, the Club for Growth, and all the different variants of those that go under different names and change their names like chameleons, what they've done is bring huge pots of dark money to bear on legislators. And so we have this new verb, to be primaried. And what that's getting at is this big donor network will run a primary challenge against anyone who doesn't toe the line of the donors, not the voters. And one of Charles Koch's top people actually called that the secret sauce to the donors. He said, this is our secret sauce. He called it the accountability play. And what I want Americans to understand is what they're doing with that is making elected officials answerable to the wealthy donors who are on the far right of the spectrum. People do not agree with their ideas instead of being accountable to their own constituents. And we've seen this tension with the Republican senators who some of them are buckling. They're saying, wait, my people don't want this. I'm going to vote against it. And these guys are literally threatening them.
Now, your critics, among them your colleague at Duke, George Vanberg, have said that you are, and Vanberg in particular, says that you're misrepresenting Buchanan, that you don't fully and thoroughly understand his understanding of personal liberty and that you've misrepresented it in your book.
Well, an interesting thing about these critics who are affiliated with the public choice tradition or with the libertarian movement, well, there's a couple interesting things. But one of them is many of them admit that they haven't read the book at all, right? They've picked up a piece that they know and they kind of, you know, burrow into that, but they haven't read the book at all. So it's kind of hard to take seriously critics who don't actually engage the whole work before they misrepresent it. And I would just say I have studied these ideas very deeply. And somebody even said that I hadn't read Buchanan's work. That's preposterous. You know, my husband can attest the number of nights I was sitting there, you know, underlining these works and trying to make sense of them. And I think I made pretty good sense of them. But what's happened with this cause, and I saw it in Buchanan's career, is it's always been very insular and frankly bullying at different institutions. You know, Buchanan was a very good man, very decent, very loyal, very generous with the people in his circle. But again and again, he alienated his colleagues through his abuse of power. And I believe that's the same thing you see with Charles Koch in our wider society. So at two institutions, University of Virginia and Virginia Tech, Buchanan was actually pushed out by his colleagues in the administration who got sick of being bullied. So I think I actually understand this man's thought very well. But what I have done that nobody within his tradition has done is combine his published work with what I found in his private papers and the wider historical context to help people see what these ideas actually mean as they arose in this formative crucible of the Southern schools crisis and as they've been applied pretty aggressively since 1997 when Charles Koch made his first big $10 million contribution to George Mason University, where Buchanan worked and where they have a whole kind of apparatus base camp set up for this. Now, I will say absolutely right that public choice is wider. Even Cass Sunstein is in the public choice tradition. I say that in the book. If people read the book, they would see that. So that's not really the issue. But I think, last thing, this is a cause that has never been subject to the views of an outsider with a different value system and a deep research base. And I am essentially holding up a mirror to them, and they don't like what they see.
Nancy MacLean, William Chafe Professor of History and Public Policy at Duke University. Her new book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right Stealth Plans for America. Nancy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
You can find links to her work at our website, stateofthings.org, and you can see Nancy MacLean tonight, 7 o'clock, Regulator Bookshop in Durham. Just ahead, we'll hear about a national network that's trying to fight the stereotype that African Americans avoid the great outdoors. Stay with us.